My name is Aaron. I'm one of the elders here at Severn Covenant Church. And if you've been tracking along with us, this week marks week 6, which is the culminating sermon in our series through the book of John titled Evidence. And basically, for the duration of that series, what we've been doing is unearthing, taking a look at the evidence that Jesus has left for us to analyze that's been recorded in his biographies. And specifically, we're looking at the biography of Jesus. We call it the gospel, penned by one of Jesus' personal friends and acquaintances, a gentleman by the name of John. And today we're going to look at what's described as the 7th sign. It's a very climactic sign in the story of Jesus' life. And we're going to take a peek at that. So to just bring you up to speed with where we've been, we've seen Jesus turn water to wine. We've seen Jesus heal a man who had been paralyzed for a number of decades. We've seen Jesus give sight to a man who was born blind. We've seen Jesus heal an official son from a distance by simply speaking words of healing onto that young man's life. And we've seen Jesus feed a multitude, thousands of people, basically with a bag lunch. He had a couple of loaves of bread and a few fish, and he fed everybody until they were full. And each of these signs, they reveal something very unique about the person and work of Jesus. And as we examine today's evidence, today's sign, that 7th sign, what I'd like to encourage you to consider, if you're a person who is currently following Jesus, my hope for you today is that you grow in intimacy with Jesus, that you know him on a deeper level as a result of what we're going to talk about today. And then if you're out there, you're just kind of on the fence about Christianity. Christianity really doesn't make sense to you. Maybe you have a tattered past with the church. Maybe Jesus doesn't really make sense to you. Maybe you think of him as, you know, a good teacher or a nice guy or whatever your description of him may be. What I'm asking you to do with this evidence is add it to your list of things to analyze as you attempt to come to a conclusion with regards to who Jesus is and what he came to do. So to give you a little bit of context before we dig in today, if we look at Jesus' life as a whole, the beginning of his life, his birth, his childhood, his adolescence, leaves us kind of scratching our heads. The Bible doesn't give us a lot to go off of until Jesus is about 30 years old and he launches what we call his earthly ministry. We learned about this in week 1 of this series when Jesus, the first thing that he did, the first miracle that he performed, he's at a wedding in Cana. The wine well has gone dry, and Jesus then turns water into wine. From there, the news of Jesus, the news of what he's doing, it begins to travel pretty broadly, and what we see are multitudes. These are thousands of people who are coming to see Jesus. He's attracting really large crowds, and one of the dynamics with regards to those crowds that he's attracting is typically what you're going to find are two types of people that comprise those crowds. The first type are people that they believe Jesus. As a result of what he's doing and what he's saying, they believe in him. And then the other camp that's growing is this camp of people that just, they absolutely hate him. So what we're seeing is these large crowds become increasingly more and more polarized based simply on the fact that Jesus is doing things and saying things that either are going to breathe life onto you or cause you to scratch your head and wondering, you know, why is this guy so controversial? And so with each sign, I believe that Jesus, what he's doing is he's showing us something about himself. And we are either going to fall head over heels in love with him, or we're going to starkly reject him based on what he says and what he does. And we see the tension between Jesus and religious authorities specifically. It is building. It's building to the point that people who have been impacted by these miracles, they literally represent an onslaught or an attack on the religious system of the day. Those people are easily associated with Jesus. And what we're learning is it's just as risky to follow Jesus as it is to be Jesus at this point in time. And it's becoming more and more clear that something crazy is going to happen with regards to Jesus' life. We're coming to a real turning point. He's speaking more openly about who he is and what he's came to do. He's speaking more pointedly about his impending death. He's speaking more candidly and freely with religious officials. He's engaging in the debates. He's going toe-to-toe with the religious authorities of the day. And so if we pick up from where we left off last week, we're in chapter 9. If you cruise through chapter 10, where it ends is with Jesus on the run. He's running for safety because people literally want to kill him as a result of the things that he's saying. And so that's where we're going to pick up. We're going to go ahead and pick up in chapter 11. We'll work through verses 1 through 44. So if you have your Bible, that's where we're going to hang out today. I won't be reading all of those verses verbatim. There's a lot of really like rich cultural nuances there. There are a lot of little side notes, a lot of things happening in this text that I'm not even going to talk about. We're going to zoom in on some very specific aspects of what's happening, things that we can learn or ascertain about the person and work of Jesus through these verses. So I'll give you some summaries, and then we'll zoom in on some of those very specific verses as we work through the text today. And what we find in chapter 11 is a narrative. It's about Jesus, and this particular point in the narrative about Jesus highlights a relationship that he has. It's a very personal relationship with a specific family. It's a pair of sisters, Martha and Mary, and their brother Lazarus. And the text that we read in our Bible says that Jesus loved them. That's not a term that's openly used with regards to how Jesus feels about specific people. Generically, Jesus loves the world that he made. God sent him to rescue and redeem the world. But there are very few times upon which the Bible specifically says Jesus loved fill in the blank. John is one of those people. This family seems to meet that criteria as well. And what's happening for this family is something that we can all relate to. Lazarus gets sick, to the point where his life literally is hanging in the balance. As a result of Lazarus' ill health, Martha and Mary, who Jesus loves, they send for Jesus. They're very familiar with his ministry. They're very familiar with what he's capable of doing. And they basically send a message to Jesus, and they're saying, Jesus, Lazarus, the one you love, he's sick. And they're summoning him to get up from where he is and to move to where they are. But it's really interesting what Jesus chooses to do, because he does not immediately respond. And in the meanwhile, Lazarus dies. And all, mourning and grieving erupt in the town of Bethany where this family resides. They're mourning the loss of a loved one. And we're going to zoom in on the account of what Jesus does in response to Lazarus' death in the attempt to learn something very unique about the person and work of Jesus today. And so I'd like for you to keep this in mind as we work through this text, that Jesus' actions, his words, everything that he did, extremely calculated and strategic. He doesn't do anything that doesn't make sense outside of the context of what he's come to do. What I mean there is everything that he says, everything that he does is within the realm of what he's supposed to do and what he's supposed to say. There's no mistake in the person and work of Jesus. And so what I'm really aiming at here is something that the Bible is very specific about when it comes to who Jesus is. And that, my friends, is found in chapter 1 of the book that we call Hebrews. And if you look at verse 3, what it says there is that Jesus is the radiance of God's glory and the exact expression of his nature. So in other words, Jesus is God. He is literally God introducing himself to humanity. What you see in Jesus is the exact representation of God. And everything that Jesus is doing is his attempt to guarantee that you have an opportunity to know who he is so that your life can be completely transformed. And so the first idea that I'm just going to present to you this morning and ask you to consider is that Jesus, he reveals God through our reality. And we're going to zoom in on chapter 5 specific, or verse 5 in chapter 11 of John's Gospel, where we read, "Now Jesus loved Martha, her sister, and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was." Now, on a surface level, I don't know about you guys, but I'm a little bit perplexed by what Jesus does here. The Bible explicitly says he loves these people. These people are asking for help. And then the next verse we read, verse 6 says, so when he heard about the fact that they needed help, he waited. He stayed 2 more days. He didn't move. He stayed in a chair, per se. He hung out where he was. He stayed put. There is no immediate response that we get from Jesus here. And I think we could go down the path of, well, Jesus, get up and go. Like, do your thing. Do what you can do. Heal Lazarus. Respond to your friends. Love on your friends. But he doesn't do that. He waits. He waits. And here's the other little side note. You know, we can reflect back on what Jesus did for the official's son. And he simply, from a great distance, spoke. And that man's son was healed. So why? Why is he not doing that now? He's fully capable of doing it, but he's not doing it. And then you go right up to verse 7, and what we read there is that Jesus tells his disciples that it's time to go back to Judea. And you gotta give these guys credit. They love Jesus. Their love for him is very flawed because they're people. They're flawed just like we are. You know, it's as flawed as I try to love my wife, but my love for her is still flawed. It's still growing. It's still being refined, shaped, and formed. These guys say to Jesus, they're like, hold back. It's not in your best interest to go to Judea because, Jesus, that's where the most people hate you. That was basically the epicenter of hatred that was being aimed at Jesus. So they're really looking out for him. And it's very clear also by their response that they haven't really begun to wrap their minds around Jesus' identity and what he came to do. And what we read there is that, before I say this, but what Jesus tells them specifically is he says, hey guys, Lazarus is sleeping, I'm going to wake him up. And so they're like, if he's asleep, doesn't he have an alarm clock? I mean, I think he's going to, you know, nobody sleeps forever. He'll probably wake up. And so Jesus gets real with them and he says, Lazarus has died. He's dead. He can't wake himself up. And then he follows that, or he chases it with, and I am glad for your sake that I wasn't there so you may believe. But let's go to him. And then Thomas, who's commonly referred to as the twin, said to the other disciples that were there, he says, let's go with him so that we may die with him. So Jesus mentions his friend Lazarus' death, and then he immediately follows that with an I'm glad statement. So let's just pause to clarify. Jesus is in no wise happy about his friend's death. He's not glad that death has claimed another life. He's not glad that death is still wreaking havoc on humanity. Jesus is glad because he's about to do something through our circumstance, through our death-riddled circumstance. He's about to work through that circumstance to reveal to us something about himself and something about God. What Jesus is going to do is motivated by the fact that Jesus simply wants us to trust him. He wants his disciples to believe. He wants us to believe. He wants the world to believe that he is, in fact, God. So Jesus, through Lazarus' death, is planning to unveil in a very tangible, in a very real way, the identity of God himself. And this might sound a little crass to put it this way. Jesus he's not motivated by raising dead people to life. Like, that's not really what he's aiming at doing. Because here's the thing. Think about this for about 10 seconds. Your life preserved as it is forever. Yeah, I didn't get one amen from that. Because I don't know about you, but I got some growing up to do. All right, think about it. Your life preserved as it is forever. I'm sorry, I refuse that. I don't want that. I'm sold on the fact that that is not what Jesus is preserving. He is preserving something deeper than merely just keeping me alive forever. And he is going to do something in the life of Lazarus that's going to show us a picture of ultimately what he is planning on doing with all of creation. Furthermore, he is not motivated because someone came up to him and said, hey, Jesus, my family's sick, please help me. I'm not saying that he doesn't respond to our requests or our needs, but there's something bigger, there's something more at work in this text. And basically, Jesus is responding to the request. He's going to raise Lazarus from the dead for our sake, not for Lazarus' sake. And to add to why I believe that, if you go to chapter 12, what you're going to find is that our friend Lazarus, who's raised to mortal life all over again, he has a death sentence. He's got a target on his back, and the same people that hate Jesus want him dead because he represents what Jesus represents. So there's got to be something bigger at work here. And so let's go ahead and we'll keep pushing right through. And we're going to go ahead and pick up in verse 17. And there we see Jesus arriving at Bethany. This is the town where Lazarus has died, where Lazarus' family is mourning the loss of their loved one. And he's quickly met by Martha. And Martha is very open with Jesus. And I think what she does is almost kind of like, I don't know if I would do that, but then I have to realize that that's kind of what I do. She expresses very openly that she's disappointed in Jesus. She tells him, Jesus, you are too late. There's nothing you can do. My brother is dead. If you would have came sooner, you could have prevented all of this. She's expressing a deep level of disappointment in Jesus' failure to respond immediately to her request. And then later, Mary comes, her sister, and her posture is markedly different. She actually falls on her face before Jesus, and she's weeping and she's crying, but she says exactly the same thing. You're too late. Our brother already died. We were anticipating that you were going to solve our problem, solve his problem, but you didn't. We're disappointed in you, Jesus. And I think what Jesus does is very interesting. But I think we also have to consider who has not been where Mary and Martha are, where life, it's pressing in on you. You're in a relationship that's falling apart. Maybe financially you have no idea which way is up. The goal for your life is just not being met, whatever the case may be. And all you're saying is, God, just give me a sense of release. God, turn the table, turn the tide, change my circumstance. And again, Jesus is not interested in merely changing our circumstance. He's doing something more. And so we're going to take a deeper look at how Jesus responds very uniquely to each of these women who have said exactly the same thing to him. And the point that I'd like to drive home as we do that is that Jesus is fully capable of empathizing with our reality. And what I mean there is, we can zoom in on two terms that I think both we're all familiar with, the first of which is sympathy. And sympathy, by way of definition, it's an expression of pity or sorrow for someone's misfortune. You know, you're basically saying when someone dies, you're like, hey, our condolences. It's not imbibed. There's nothing really behind it. It's just a culturally appropriate thing to do to express sorrow based on the fact that somebody lost their job or they lost a loved one. Empathy, on the other hand, is markedly deeper. It's markedly different. And this is what Jesus is fully capable of doing with us. Empathy is actually sharing and understanding a person's sorrow. It's entering in to their sorrow. It's literally you experiencing sorrow with them. You're in the pit of despair with someone who is in the pit of despair, and you're experiencing it with them. So sympathy, if I wanted to summarize it, sympathy is what you're going to get in any Hallmark card you pull off of the shelf. Right, it's about an inch deep. Doesn't really solve anybody's problems. Doesn't even really, maybe it brightens your day for a moment, but it's very superficial. Empathy, however, is someone doing life alongside you, experiencing sorrow with you, and walking it out with you. And so, a closer look at Jesus' exchanges with these two young ladies, Martha and Mary, is going to show us something about Jesus. And I believe his two distinct responses, and we'll talk a little more in depth about this, show us that Jesus is both fully God and fully man. And if you are a theology buff, you know, and you get excited about really big words, what we're talking there is the hypostatic union of Jesus, meaning that at the same time he's fully God, he's also fully man. Don't spend too much time there. I think the big thing you need to know about Jesus is he loves saving sinners. Let's just rest there for the rest of our lives, okay? So with Martha, Jesus does not, he does not engage emotionally, which I personally am like, okay, you're kind of insensitive, Jesus. You're not even engaging emotionally with someone who just lost their brother. You're not going to engage emotionally with them? Come on, at least, you know, give them a hug and tell them you're sad. But he doesn't even do that. Here's what he does. He gives her this, like, extremely high-level theology about resurrection. He basically says, your brother will be alive again. And then she tracks with him a little bit, and she's like, oh, yeah, I get it. You know, you're going to raise the dead on the last day. That is like an idea that's up here. It doesn't impact me on the ground level. But that's what Jesus gives her. And he's kind of like proverbially grabbing her by the shoulders and saying, guess what? I'm here. It's not too late. Eventually, this all works out. Eventually, it's worth it. And she says, I know, Jesus. I know that the dead will rise again. But he comes back because I don't think that she gets it. And he basically is saying, no, you don't get it. You don't understand. And he gets very pointed and very specific about his identity. And he says this, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me, even if he dies, will live. Everyone who lives and believes in me will never die ever. And he leaves her with a question, and the question is simply, do you believe this? What Jesus is doing here is he's turning her attention from a mere belief in a theological idea to the God who is more powerful than any theological idea out there. Jesus is saying, I am not here to echo the idea that the dead will be raised again. He's saying, belief, mere belief in the resurrection is not going to get you anywhere. It's not going to save you. It's not going to rescue you. He's standing in front of Martha and he's saying, I am God's response to death. I am the resurrection and I am the life. Do you trust me? Ultimately, what he is claiming right then and right there is, Martha, I am God in the flesh. You are looking into the eyes of God. So, that's kind of where it abruptly ends with Martha and Jesus. And she kind of sneaks back home, and she sneaks back into her house. Granted, her house is full of people who've come from Jerusalem. And remember, Jerusalem is where people hate Jesus. They've come by way of custom. It's just culturally appropriate for people to come and mourn the loss of a loved one. They're in the home of Martha and Mary. Martha runs, sneaks into her house, and she's like, hey, Mary, the teacher is here. And so Mary, she tries to sneak out of the house, but she can't. So she's got this trail of people who are following her because they're convinced that she's going to the tomb to mourn the death of Lazarus. And so Mary approaches Jesus, and again, her posture is markedly different. She's in tears. She's on her knees. She's in front of Jesus. And by way of action, she's saying, I am blown away. I'm ravaged. I'm a wreck as a result of experiencing the loss of a loved one. But at the same time, I'm highly disappointed in you, Jesus, because you did nothing to mitigate this problem. You didn't stop it. You allowed it to happen. And Jesus shows us a whole new level of who he is. And instead of responding with brutal truth, the way that he responded to Martha, he does something markedly different. When Jesus saw her crying, and the Jews who had come with her crying, he was angry in his spirit and deeply moved. Where have you put him? He asked. Lord, they told him, come and see. And then it says that Jesus wept. Okay, this is a stark contrast. A few minutes ago, he's talking about, I'm God. It's going to be okay. I'm here to rescue you. And moments later, he seems to be on this, like swept away by this sea of emotions. The Bible tells us he's both angry and he's sad to the degree that he is openly crying. He's becoming emotionally vulnerable. And what he's doing is he's entering in to the sorrow that Mary is experiencing. He's experiencing it with her. He's grieving. And I think there's something that you really need to know about the fact that he's angry. He is in no wise angry at Mary or Martha for their expression of disappointment in him. That's not why he's mad. His response to Mary shows us that while Jesus is fully God, he's not just deity. He's also fully human. And because he's fully human, he can embrace Mary where she is. He can empathize with her. He can walk through sorrow with her. He can feel the tragic, horrific reality, the grip, the sting, the pain of death and grief. He can fully experience it the way that we experience it. And these responses, what they show us about Jesus is that he possesses an extremely profound, deep, relational wisdom. He's basically a perfect counselor. And the reason why he's a perfect counselor is because he's capable of entering our reality, not to merely recognize that life is hard or acknowledge the fact that we're living in times where we're experiencing pain and turmoil, but he's empathizing with us through it. And he's not just empathizing with us through it, he's responding by giving us exactly what we need. Jesus, he could have very easily come to the town of Bethany, heard about the disappointment, and actively rebuked both Mary and Martha by way of saying, hey, I'm God. I'm never wrong. My moves are always sovereign. I know more than you know. He could have easily put them in their place because he's deity. But he's not just deity. He's also capable of fully experiencing the range of emotion that we experience. And he's fully capable of empathizing with us where we stand. And so Jesus gives these two sisters very distinct responses. The first one is embracing, it's called bracing truth. It's like just the raw reality of truth. It's, hey, that's wrong, this is right. With Mary, he does something markedly different. He responds by way of entering into her sorrow and experiencing the emotions that she's experiencing. And as human beings, if you're anything like me, I'm going to guess that this is exactly the range of approach that you need from your friends. You need, at times, for that friend to come to you with a bracing truth. You need them to just get down to the nitty-gritty of how you're supposed to live. Because the reality of what Jesus is doing in us, he's not preserving us as we are. He's making us into who we should be. And so therefore, bracing truth is going to give us a prime opportunity to walk away from sin instead of living in it. Can I get an amen? Amen. All right. So you're still awake. You're still alive. We're still doing good. Awesome. But in addition to that, I also need somebody that's going to weep with me when I need them to weep with me. Because how difficult is this? How disturbing is this when you just simply need someone to embrace you and tell you it's going to be okay, and they come at you with some high-level, ridiculous truth that doesn't change your circumstance. All it does is say, hey, you can't relate to me. Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus gives you exactly what you need, exactly when you need it. And he's the perfect blend of being strong when he needs to be strong and being absolutely tender when he needs to be tender. And that's what he's doing with Martha and Mary. And this, my friends, is a struggle that we have. We don't know when to be strong or when to be weak. And if we're strong, we tend to just be overbearing and we put a lot of pressure on people. And if we're weak, we really don't know how to tell people the truth. So Jesus is showing us something that is within the realm of his capacity as our perfect counselor. And we need to trust him. And that's simply what he's encouraging us to do. So Jesus, he's able to empathize with our reality because he knows exactly what we need. And he's not in the business of giving you superficial pity or raw truth at an inappropriate or inopportune time. He doesn't give a bunch of pat answers. Jesus literally enters the turmoil of our reality as a wise and loving God. And only a wise and loving God can love us the way that we need to be loved. And only a God become man can empathize with us the way that we need to be empathized with. Jesus is God become man, and it's Jesus' love for mankind that allows him to enter the turmoil of Martha and Mary's circumstance, the turmoil of our lives, and to empathize with us by giving us exactly what we need. Because of who Jesus is, he is able to approach us as the God higher than the stars while engaging within our lives with a compassion that's absolutely deeper than the sea. But here's the thing, he doesn't just empathize with us. He does far more than that. And this is the next point that I'd like to make, that through empathizing with us, what Jesus is really doing, what he's aiming to accomplish is, he is aiming to completely change our reality. Jesus is aiming to completely change our reality. And we're going to pick up in verse 38. And there we read, "Then Jesus, angry in himself again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. 'Remove the stone,' Jesus said. Martha, the dead man's sister, told him, 'Lord, he's already decaying. It's been 4 days.' Jesus said to her, 'Didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?' So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, 'Father, I thank you that you heard me. I know that you always hear me, but because of the crowd standing here, I said this so they may believe you sent me.' After he said this, he shouted with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come out.' The dead man came out bound hand and foot with linen strips and with his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to them, 'Loose him, let him go.'" So verse 38 highlights Jesus' emotional state. It tells us again, he is angry. He's deeply moved. And if you look at the original Greek that's there, it's not just, you know, he's angry the way that we would understand anger. He's literally bellowing with anger. He's fired up. He's raging with anger. And he's bellowing with anger, interestingly, as he approaches the tomb, which I find to be quite odd. As I, you know, when I'm walking through a cemetery, I'm not bellowing with anger. I'm kind of like just sobered by the fact that one day my body's going to be laid to rest. Jesus is bellowing with anger as he walks to the tomb. He's openly refusing to acknowledge the finality of death. That's what he's doing. He's raging against death. He's not raging against disbelief or people. He is raging against death that has a grip on people, the death that has claimed the life of his friend Lazarus. He is getting ready to go toe-to-toe with our greatest fear, the loss of a loved one, grief, the anguish and pain of saying goodbye, death itself. Jesus is gearing up to look death in the face and do something about it. And ever since sin entered the world, we've been dealing with the plague of death. And Paul, he puts it like this when he writes to the Romans or the church at Rome. He says, "Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man and death through sin, in this way death spread to all men because all sinned." So death has stood in the way of life from that moment that sin entered the world, conquering it at every bend, defying life at every opportunity. Our lives, our routines, the way that we approach our day, everything is driven by this concept of death. And I'm not saying that we're hyper-interested or focused on death. I'm just saying that is the binding agreement on our lives, that we are going to die. And so we make moves with that in mind. We make decisions with that in mind. And as we live out our years, we get closer and closer to anticipating that time, and our mindset changes. But we're driven by it. We think about it. We're concerned by it. We're ravaged by it when we see people that we love die. If we look at the Old Testament, there's a writer by the name of Isaiah. He's a prophet. He talks about death that completely enshrouds, covers absolutely everything. But then he also talks about this day that is coming, a day that he longs for, when death will be absolutely put to rest. As Jesus approaches Lazarus' tomb, he's well aware of the grip of death. The pain of death has filled the hearts of the people in attendance that day. The smell of death, it's in the air. The noise, the sound of death is coming from the mouths of people who are weeping and wailing because death to them is final. Jesus is incensed at death's hold on humanity. Jesus is absolutely fed up with evil, sickness and suffering. And that's what that's the sentiment he has when he's marching toward that tomb. So here's a question about Jesus. If he's so powerful, if he's so mighty, what's he waiting for? Like, wouldn't it be really great if evil ended today? Wouldn't it be really great if he just put an end to it, like stamp it, it's done, it's over? The Bible is extremely explicit as to why that hasn't happened. It tells us why the world is so messed up, why we struggle with certain things, why sin still has a grip on us. It's very, very explicit with regards to the misery and pain and turmoil in the world. And it points to one thing. And that one thing is the human heart. It points to the human heart as the epicenter of sin. So if Jesus comes wielding the sword of wrath against evil, guess what? We will not live to tell the tale. We wouldn't make it. No one would make it. Something bigger has to happen because our hearts are filled with pride, selfishness, lust, racism, prejudice. I mean, you name it. Our hearts are ravaged by sin. And as a result, the world ravaged by sin. So Jesus doesn't just merely put an end to death because we wouldn't make it if he did. In marching to the tomb of Lazarus, he's showing us exactly what he came to do. He's showing us that he is interested. He has a vested interest, a pointed interest, a driven interest in absolutely changing everything we know about reality. So he moves toward the tomb and he says, "Open it." And this is absolutely confusing if you were there. Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. There's no turning back after 4 days in their minds. They can smell his body decomposing. This is perplexing. They don't know what to do with what Jesus is saying. They basically ask him not to open the tomb, but then they open it. And Jesus tells them, "Brace yourselves. You're about to see God live. You're about to see something that you've never seen." And before he makes a further move, he pauses and he says, "God, thank you." And then he clarifies why he's doing what he's doing. And he says, "I'm doing this so that people will know that I am God, know that you sent me, so people will have a viable opportunity to trust me with everything that they have." And he shouted with a loud voice. He said, "Lazarus, come out." And Lazarus came out of the tomb. We're going to go ahead and wind down as the worship team comes up here this morning. So Jesus, he does not raise Lazarus from the tomb for the sake of improving Lazarus' quality of life. Lazarus dies again. That's just the sad reality of Lazarus' life. And in addition to that, again, in chapter 12, you're going to read that people hate Lazarus because Jesus made him alive. Really, really weird that someone would hate a dead guy for being alive again, but they hate him. They want to kill him, and the reason they want to kill him is he is a living reminder that Jesus is like no other. Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead with a very specific purpose in mind. He knew something that his disciples had no idea about when they made their way to Bethany. They knew that something tragic was going to happen to Jesus. They knew that he was gearing up to die, but they had no idea what the implications of what this move meant. In going to Bethany and raising Lazarus from the dead, Jesus was summoning his own death sentence. He was saying, "Lazarus' death is the signal for me to lay my life on the line, for me to risk absolutely everything for people that I love." He knew that the moment Lazarus's feet crossed the threshold of that tomb, that word would travel 1.7 miles to Jerusalem, the place where people were seething in rage against Jesus. He knew that they would find out that he was up to doing what simply he came to do. Jesus did not come into this world with a sword. Jesus came into this world with nails. He did not come to bring judgment. He came to bear judgment on our behalf. I need you to hear this. Jesus knew that the only way to bring Lazarus out of the grave, the only way to interrupt our funeral, to bring us out of the grave, was for him to put himself in the grave. He knew this. It was clear in his mind. He knew exactly what he was doing when he was raising Lazarus from the dead. He knew that in order to defeat death, He would have to endure the judgment that you and I deserved. This is why he approached Lazarus's tomb. He's got tears running down his face. He's angry. He's upset because he knew exactly how much he loved us, and he knew exactly how much it was going to cost him. And despite the cost, he stood in front of that tomb and he called Lazarus out of it. And the people that bore witness to that said, "Wow, look how much he loved Lazarus." And I'm saying, "Wow, look how much he loves you, church. Look how he risked everything so that you don't have to. Look how he paid a price that you didn't have to pay, that you should, frankly, have paid. Look how he looked down on humanity that was ravaged and torn and ripped apart by sin. On humanity that continuously is just destroying itself, trying with no avail, with no hope to get out from underneath the bondage of sin. Jesus looked on that and he entered our reality as God become a man. He entered our sorrow, he entered our pain, he entered our suffering, and he absolutely endured our suffering so that he could completely change what you and I call reality. Every piece of evidence that we've looked at for the past 6 weeks makes it abundantly clear that every word Jesus spoke, every move Jesus made, everything that Jesus did was not for the sake of doing things that made people clap and made people happy. It was for the sake of giving people an opportunity to know that there is a God who is absolutely in love with humanity to the degree that he's willing to risk everything so that they can find a place of rest in him. Jesus is fixing. And when I say that, he's not just making things better. Jesus is absolutely fixing everything that has been broken and destroyed by sin. And here's the raw truth of the matter. Jesus can bring dead people back to life because Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Jesus can restore sight to the blind man because Jesus is the light of the world. Jesus can feed the multitudes, the thousands, because Jesus is the bread of life. Jesus can restore the health of the official's son and restore the health of the paralytic because Jesus is the great healer. Jesus can turn water into wine because Jesus is completely reorienting our hopes, our expectations, and our dreams, and he's preparing a place for us. He's preparing to once and for all welcome us home with a feast that's just going to blow your hair back. This is what Jesus is doing. If you're here today and you don't know Jesus, just track with me for a little bit. Jesus is the embodiment of a real God who has a real passionate love for real people like you and me. Real people who at the end of the day, if we get out a calculator, you're going to be left with two lists. One is the list of things that you think you did right, and maybe that'll make you feel good. And the other one is the list of things that you know in the bottom of your heart that you dropped the ball, you failed. And the fact of the matter is you have no place to rest your hope and your life on either of those lists. So Jesus is offering something greater. He's offering his perfect life in substitution for yours. He's offering his atoning death on your behalf. And he has risen from the dead to secure a life that's not a preservation of the one that you currently know. It's one that you've never known. You will be who you should be as a result of Jesus' finished work. Jesus is constantly and consistently ripping people from the grip of sin and giving them life. That's what the evidence we've examined shows. That's where our hope is. And friends, this is the seventh sign of our Savior, and that's all I have for you this morning.